The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Here last week, I gave a talk that was meant to explore the first of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are kind of core teachings of the Buddha, and it said that all of Buddhism kind of emerges out of these four particular truths. And one of the aspects of these truths is that they're not meant to be something to believe in. They're not like truths like you need to believe these truths. But rather they're kind of pragmatic truths. They're truths that call upon certain actions, practices. And so the first truth is the truth of the suffering that exists in this world, in ourselves, and the action connected to that is to understand it. So last week we spent the evening kind of exploring, trying to understand the nature of suffering, in particular understanding our relationship to suffering. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering, and the cause is seen to be craving or clinging, and the action connected to that is to let go of the clinging or the grasping. The fourth noble truth is a truth of the end of suffering that comes with the end of grasping, and that is something to be realized. So the action is to realize that. And the fourth noble truth is the path of practice that can be cultivated to help us release the clinging or grasping. And so that the action there is to be cultivated. So to understand, to let go, to realize, and to cultivate. And so this evening I wanted to explore a little bit, like we did yesterday, last week, the second noble truth, and the issue of craving and clinging. And I was hoping we'd do it a little bit interactively like we did last week, where I can ask you some questions and we can kind of create the Dharma talk together with your understandings, your ideas of this important topic. So craving is, I like the word, is desire which is has a compulsive quality to it. So in being compulsive, it's not something that's easy to let go of. It's something that has a kind of hold on us. And because it has a hold on us, it brings along psychological and physiological reactions within us. Physically, there might be clenching, gripping, tension we hold in our shoulders or belly or face or any kind of place at all. And then psychologically, there can be something comparable where there's some, we won't let up on it. We're kind of like, there's an insistent quality. And that insistent quality, sometimes the compulsive quality of the desire, of the wanting, can really can put a lot of pressure on us, and that pressure can lead to, can be a form of suffering, and can lead to a lot of frustration, or a lot of compulsive activity as well. And there's many things that people can grasp onto, to cling to, and that's one of the things to interesting to explore, is what is we cling to. And, you know, we could be here all evening, all night, and all week, drawing up a list of the things human beings cling to and therefore suffer. The task in the second noble truth, that of letting go or abandoning clinging, is that this is something only you can do. Only you can, if you're suffering about something, let's say that you really want ice cream, and you really have to have ice cream, and you're kind of stuck at IMC now. You can't really leave in the middle of the talk. You know, it wouldn't be very becoming. And so you're sitting here at the edge of your seat. When is he going to stop talking so I can get to the ice cream store before they close? And you feel it's impatient and really need to go. And you could sit here and suffer because of it. And if you were going to free yourself from that suffering and stay, you can't expect me to let go. I could let go of my ice cream from all night long, And that's not going to help you if you're still clinging to it. So you're, for you to let go, for you to be free of that suffering that comes from wanting ice cream, you have to do the work of letting go. The letting go is something very personal. And it's, you know, so it's easy enough to say, see it with a silly example of ice cream, but it's not so easy to see it perhaps when someone has been angry with you and you suffer in that anger because there's a kind of injustice. They've been angry with you. But the task of the Four Noble Truths is not necessarily to, you know, it doesn't say what you should do with that person, go back and talk to them, work it out, or do something. But it tries to address this particular issue of the nature of your suffering around that. And your responsibility in relationship to it, your contribution to it. And the very challenging teaching here is that if you suffer, then there's something about the nature of suffering that you have a contribution to. And if there's going to be some letting go happening, you're the one who has to do it. So the task is to understand, what is your contribution to this? How is it that you're kind of caught in this whatever? It's not meant to dismiss the injustice or dealing with the problem that's been done to you, if it needs to be dealt with. But it's the issue of can you deal with it appropriately without suffering, without being oppressed by it? To what degree is your inner psychological oppression something that actually you cause yourself, as opposed to something that seems to be caused from outside? We've had fantastic, wonderful examples in this world of people who have, in a social way, been oppressed by others, politically, socially, in many ways, but have maintained a beautiful sense of inner dignity and freedom, independent of what people do to them. Psychologically, they haven't been oppressed or allowed that to kind of inside. So to understand, what is it, you know, so understand, what is it, my contribution? Another area, way of looking at this issue of craving is, those of you who don't believe you have any cravings or any clingings or attachments, is how quickly do you get concentrated when you sit down to meditate? And how well do you get concentrated? Because most of the hindrances to get concentrated, the reason, you know, the mind gets pulled off into its different concerns and whatever, is because there's a compulsive quality there. There's a grasping or a clinging or a preoccupation there with something. And then, and as long as you're preoccupied, as long as the mind gets sucked in to some concern, it's clinging. And when you realize that, and you look at your mind in meditation, you realize that clinging is a much bigger part of human life than you realized. We know that one of the great addictions is to thinking, to our thoughts and ideas. And so so meditation is a great way, when you try to concentrate and be focused, that if you're able to let go well of your concerns of the day and your attachments and everything, you can get relatively quiet and still. If you can't let go, then you can see, wow, I didn't realize that how caught up I was. I didn't realize how important these kinds of issues were and how I was glued to them so tightly, whatever it might be. What's interesting with meditation is that as your mind gets stiller and stiller, more calmer and more deeper, that some of the deeper and deeper structures of attachment, or the deeper kind of more insidious foundational attachments that often are invisible to ourselves, get revealed, get shown. And in daily life, you might not realize that, you know, some of the deeper issues that are there. But as you get quieter, you might see some of the deeper things. So part of the task of Buddhism, Buddhist practice, is not only to study suffering, to understand it, but also to understand the clinging, the grasping, the compulsivity, which seems to be connected to it. And sometimes it's easy to see, and sometimes it's hard to discover what that might be. So there are many things we might cling to. Before we go into that, what I'd like to ask you, or talk to you about it, between the thing you cling to and your mind, the freedom of your mind, the openness of your awareness, something happens where the idea that you're clinging to, the thing you're clinging to, and you get glued together, get entangled. There's a magnetic field, a gravitational field that pulls you into them. There's glue. There's some way in which you can't separate those out, because if you could separate it easily, you could let go and just go along your merry way. And you can just let go of ice cream thoughts and just listen to the talk. But you can't let go of the ice cream thoughts, desires, and you're kind of latched on. So what do you think that glue is? That's the question for you. What do you think that glue is between what you're attached to and you being attached? What is the glue of attachment?
Is it ego?
Okay, so that's and there might be many glues, but let's see. So ego is one possibility. So self-concept, self-identity, yeah. Selfishness, variety of things like that. Okay. What else? So just pass it down there.
Well, I notice for myself it's habit.
Habit?
Yes. It's just a way of thinking that just pops up, and it's just a habit.
So there's deep grooves of habit set in the emotion in the mind. So your mind just kind of falls into that condition, those conditions. So being conditioned, repeated, doing things over and over again, the mind is conditioned to operate that way, and so it latches on. Okay, so habit. Yes, on the outer hall. So wait for the mic. We only have one mic working, so.
I think I can fix it by thinking about it. That I have some control over the things I'm thinking about. And I know that's not true, but I do believe that that's what, I'm going to figure it out.
So part of the glue is the idea that you have control, agency, you're going to figure it out, you're going to fix it. So that kind of keeps you locked in.
Right.
Okay, great. Can you pass it here to your left?
I think that whatever it is, the bottom line that keeps you stuck is a lack of acceptance to the way things are.
So a lack of acceptance, that can be the part of the glue.
I think the genetic and biology plays a big role.
How close the synapses are. If some people's synapses are really close, it kind of puts more kind of fire, synaptic fire, in firing off clinging and grasping. And some people are so lucky, they just have wide gaps in their synapses. And so, those firing of grasping just doesn't reach someplace. So there might be something like that, and there might be some aspect of that going on. The strength of it.
It could be fear, because you have to cling so tightly to keep yourself together, so if you let go, you might fall into this bottomless pit.
So fear might be the glue that holds clinging to things?
Or a fear of who you are when you're not clinging.
So fear again, but in this time fear of who you might be if you're not clinging. If you're not clinging, how would you know who you are? Especially if that's all you've ever known is clinging self, and that's how you oriented yourself to your life, then to the world around you, is through the filter of the person who clings. And if you don't have that, and maybe your friends won't know how to talk to you, they won't recognize you. Okay?
I think this is also about fear, but it's the delusion that the thing that I'm clinging to is going to provide some kind of safety.
So this is a kind of a delusion or idea that what I cling to will provide me with something. So it could, here she said, safety, but it could be many things. It's an idea of what the thing's going to do for me. And it's that idea, that imaginary act, that can be part of the glue. Okay?
Well, similar, that the idea of clinging to it, or that if figuring it out will bring some kind of peace or happiness once you've gotten it or you've figured it out or whatever.
So there's a desire for peace, but the thought is that if I only can figure it out, I'll get it. I think out my problems enough, I'll have a solution. And I'll just sit here and think, and think, and think. And I thunk that. Okay, that's great. That's a nice kind of scratching the surface. Hopefully that'll get you thinking now some more. And maybe during the course of the week, you could reflect a little bit about what your glue is. Because the glue is different than what you cling to. And one of the ways to question this whole kind of mechanism, process of clinging, is to look at the glue. And some things that we cling to, the thing we cling to, might actually be a fine thing to pursue. It might be worthwhile. But it's not worthwhile to cling to it. And if you could separate out those two, then perhaps you can do your pursuit without the clinging. Letting go doesn't mean to let go of healthy things, appropriate things, but we let go of that clinging to it. So in the Buddhist tradition, there's a list of four primary clingings. I mean, there are many clingings, but this is a really juicy list. And the word, in this case, for clinging, is the word is upadana. And upadana, in the Buddhist language, is a very interesting word because it means clinging, but it also means fuel. And so clinging is a fuel for further clinging. So it's kind of self-perpetuating kind of phenomena. It keeps us in a cycle of being caught up. And so the idea is to kind of, if you can kind of get rid of the fuel, the fire cools down, dies out, the fire of suffering. So, and I'm going to give you these, I'm going to do one at a time, the list of four, and I'm going to do the list backwards. Because if I did the usual way, too many of you, I'm afraid, would protest right away, shut down, turn off, say, forget this, you know, this is, you know, unreasonable. But if I start with the end, you'll be right along with it and excited. Oh, yeah, that's fantastic. I can do that. That makes sense. And, you know, this letting go makes sense. You know, I'm good. But, and then maybe by the time you get to the end of the list, which is really the beginning of the list, you'll be more positively disposed to maybe consider that maybe, yes, this could be a form of clinging. So, what? Yes. And so what I like to do is like to mention what these categories are, and then for you to fill us in a little bit with some examples of how people cling, maybe not you, if that's, but in theory, how someone, you know, could cling to this particular category of clinging. So the first one, which is the last one, is to ethics and spiritual practices. So clinging to ethics and spiritual practices. This is one of the great forms of clinging that it causes suffering for people. So now Buddhism puts a great emphasis on importance on ethics and spiritual practices. So this is not meant to kind of like, okay, let's go party. But the clinging to ethics and spiritual practices. So how does that work? Well, how do people do that? Yes, I'm asking.
I know I It's the judging mind. It's I'm right, you're wrong, and this is why, and I'm going to tell you why. And you know, it's the finger pointing. I have the inside knowledge. I'm better.
So great. So in relationship to religion, you know, ethics and spiritual practices, there's a lot of clinging to the right and wrong around that particular thing. And the curious thing is, but people cling to all kinds of opinions. Why can it be? Why is it so significant around religion, religious things? Because I could cling to which is the right ice cream to eat.
Well, I'm actually not really sure about that because I don't really share that in terms of. Well, I do in terms of, you know, I do judge people. Yeah, if it's unethical, it in some way shames me when it really offends my sense of how life should be and my sense of order in the world.
And so because of that that shaming and that upset, there's clinging then, grasping that can happen for you. Okay, so great. So grasping around ethics and spiritual practices because of a strong feeling, a righteous feeling, there should be order in this world and good in this world, and get latched on because of that. Great. Okay. Someone else.
I think in terms of spiritual practice, that clinging can happen wanting to be perfect.
Ah, and religion is the way to be perfect.
That if I do this, if I practice, if I meditate, then it's going to all turn out. So you get attached to the outcome that you're never going to blow it.
Oh, you're never going to blow it.
Yeah. Or when it gets tough, you'll make it through.
So it's a way of being completely safe.
Yeah. The impossible. I mean, it's impossible. But it, just that, putting that pressure that... Yeah.
Great. Thank you. I guess we don't have a lot of people who cling to ethics and spiritual practices here. I thought you'd be jumping up with examples.
I know. So one thing that I end up feeling sort of religiously righteous about is something like recycling or ethics. And where that comes from in me is that I believe that I see harm being done by people who are behaving unethically or people who are acting in ways that I believe are destructive to the planet.
Uh-huh. So being concerned about the harm being done to our planet and to other people, I think is a beautiful thing, that people have that capacity of empathy and concern. But there's something that it's so easy to flip over from being concerned and being active, trying to do something, to clinging, to grasping, and then therefore suffering because of it. So I saw Jeff, yes, in the back, straight back.
Okay, there. I can use it as an organizing principle of who I am. And so if I have some religious philosophy or whatever, it kind of gives order to my world. And I can explain, well, that's why this happened and that happens to someone else. And sort of a notion of, okay, well, I'm one step closer to liberation if I hold this broader philosophy of how the world works or who I am or how I fit in that.
So in clinging to ethics and religion, religious practices, there's clinging to meaning, that don't have meaning kind of or
yeah,
order.
Clinging to me and
meaning
and having this me go more in the direction of liberation.
Okay, great. Okay. So, yes, please, move it here to the front.
Having gone through 12 years of Catholic education, I think what I cling to is a kind of a-religiousness, you know, a sort of pushing away.
So there's a form of clinging which is aversion, pushing away, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So being opposed to.
So it might tend to make me less open-minded about things.
Uh-huh. So that some of the experience you've had in that religion been upsetting or painful enough that there's an out of that, I imagine that pain or discouragement or disappointment, there's then this kind of pushing things away, not being open.
Yeah, it wasn't really pain so much as I just one day said, this is not right. But I had nothing to replace it with, uh-huh. essentially.
Uh-huh. And that resistance and pushing away and being a-religious. A person could be a-religious neutrally, no clinging, nothing. Mm-hmm. But you're saying sometimes there might be this aversion there.
And, yeah, and I think it makes my mind more closed off than it might otherwise be.
Which is a form of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great, thank you. So maybe one more here.
It occurs to me that loyalty can get tied up in this in a peculiar way. It's not that I'm clinging to this belief that I've chosen, but I'm being loyal to all of the other people who were on my side, and I can't betray them because that wouldn't be loyal. Mm-hmm. And it's obvious in the politics of our country right now, being loyal to people who believe as we do. But I recall, as I was growing up, a much more trivial example. We were a Ford family, and my dad always drove Fords. And to the day he died, he would never drive a Chevy. And it's not necessarily that Chevys were bad. It's just that Fords are our cars. And
better,
we have
better
to be...
religion. So tribal loyalty can be part of, you know, part of the clinging to religion and things. So isn't it great that we have this Buddhist religion which has built into it this recognition of the problems of being too involved in religion, too caught by religion? I like to think of Buddhism has self-protecting mechanisms in it to help protect us from over-identifying with Buddhism, against Buddhist fundamentalism. And you know, you hold Buddhism quite lightly. You know, it's, yes, one more? You want to? Okay.
Is it also a form of separation?
Yes. Being attached to religion or religious practice can help create create a sense of identity and them out there, and which can be very painful. That's part of the reason to hold on to it. Okay, so that's the first one. We don't have enough time to do all four. I would like to, if I can, like to go on and I apologize if someone wants to say, but maybe you probably have a chance because some of these same reasons appear for the other ones. But some people, it's a relief to learn. Clinging to religion or spiritual practices, meditation, boy, I can give that up easily. You know, this is good. I'm on track. So then the next one is clinging to opinions. Opinions. Now, some of the things that we've already said apply to that as well. But perhaps we can have a couple of more ideas of some examples of how people cling to opinions that really, you know. Yes, here in the front. Where's the mic now? Where are the mics? Here.
I recently had an insight, well, several years ago, that I thought I was my opinions. And if you insulted my opinion or questioned it, you are questioning my right to be who I am. That was a big insight. I can't say that it changed my life, but it did help.
It's a beautiful insight. Great. So, out of room there.
See, on a larger scale, what about, you know, certain ideologies that someone believes in and whole groups and countries, and it creates war.
Mm-hmm. So there are attachments to opinions that create war, internal and external, local and local and international.
One that I've been really surprised about since moving west is really open, seemingly open-minded people being very limited by politics.
So opinions to politics.
Yeah, and just considering themselves open-minded, but then staying so grounded in their opinion of political that they wouldn't even be open to why other people would think different things, and not necessarily having to agree, but at least being open to them.
Yes, it's everyone should be open-minded. Okay, so anyway, I'm sure, you know, so there's lots of examples of easy to quote opinions being. So that's a little bit, maybe a little harder, you know, because opinions, you know, the idea when you say attachment to opinions, no one's attached to opinions, right? But some people know what the truth is. And so a little bit hard to tease apart, you know, being attached to opinions of what other people do. But that's, you know, and, but it's not just opinions in terms of politics and all that, but it's also, I like to include in this category stories, interpretations. We make up stories about what's going on in our world all the time, and interpretations, and those we get, many people are attached to the stories. Stories of who they were, who they're supposed to be, attached to other people's stories. You know, there's all these, you know, humans are story-making creatures, and then we get attached to those stories. And so to be able to see and understand story-making is one of the paths to some freedom. And this is one of the reasons why meditation can be helpful, because it's easier in meditation to see the mind making up stories. And as you kind of separate out the stillness of the mind, the concentration of the mind, from the story-making mind, you see more and more, oh, that's opinion, that's story-making, and I'm not that. And so there's going to be the glue begins to loosen up. Yes, to Ruth there.
Now, let's see, what was I going to say? Well, when I realized that I have an opinion, like you're driving and I get mad at somebody, I began to realize I did not know what intention or, you know, in other words, I find myself acting on the basis of something that may not be true. Yeah. So that changed a lot of ways that, you know, our response, like you're on the telephone and you wait and wait and wait, and then you get mad at the person that answers. Well, one day I realized that wasn't true because he was not responsible for my waiting on the line, you know, so my idea of getting mad at him was not true.
Great. So again, so we have stories we make up, and then we get angry, upset. Not until we realize the story might not be true.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Okay, so then the third is the clinging to self. So some of these, that's already been covered a little bit, some of the examples already. But someone want to say a little bit more, some examples of how people suffer because of clinging to self.
Define self.
Define self? Me? Clinging to self-concept, self-representation, clinging to me, what's me, what's mine, what's myself. And so we don't have to get it, but this is not the philosophical discussion of self here, it's just the ordinary idea of clinging to self-concept, self-ideas, ideas of what is mine. Yes, RJ.
I was actually going to say this for opinion, but I think it works almost as well for this. I see at work a lot kind of clinging to my opinion because I'll have some idea that, which is true to some extent, but some idea or concept or clinging around being more experienced than the person that I'm working with.
So the idea that you're more experienced, so I mean, it might be true. So, but where's the suffering? Where's the clinging operating?
Ooh,
let's assume it's true.
It means kind of like I have to win the discussion, otherwise something really terrible will happen.
To you.
Yeah.
Okay, so. Here in the front, can we have?
I guess just kind of piggybacking on that, the idea that, you know, say if you do lose that discussion or the image of yourself, you know, the idea of who you are is somehow challenged by an outside force, the fact you create these images of yourself, and if that's challenged, then that could, I mean, that's the source of suffering as well. So you cling to these images of who you are, and oftentimes they can be pretty separated from actual external forces.
Uh-huh. And then, and as Ajay pointed out, then those self-images, if they're threatened, then I could sometimes it can be very frightening. Yes, please.
The rank or the role that you're playing as a member of a family or the member of a organization, that you cling to that rank or a certain role and expectation, that you know that's what others believe you are and what you believe you are and where you fit in and what you're expected to do in that position.
Great, yeah. So clinging to roles, and then sometimes we get help in clinging to roles. Other people want us to cling to those roles. Yes?
I think this is a process, and that's what makes it so hard, that the individual isn't completely in charge of the process, because if you take a newborn baby, they don't know that they should have a self, but their parents give it a name. And as soon as they give it the name, the parents think it's different from other people, and they want to know who that baby is going to turn into or something. And so the poor baby gets called a name, and he realizes people think he's somebody. I mean, the child realizes that everyone thinks he's somebody, but how in the heck is he supposed to know who he is? And it seems like that just might go on for the rest of our life, that exactly. We're always getting feedback that we're like something or other, but we don't even know if it's true or not, and so we're trying to... it's something you can't manage by yourself, I'm afraid. You can't get rid of yourself just because you'd like to, but if you had trust and less fear, I think that would be... the secret to loosening it up.
Loosening up. So I want to just tell you a story I've maybe told before, but around this example of what adults do to kids, you know, to help them coalesce around the sense of self. I was visiting some friends many years ago, and they had a 2-year-old daughter or something like that. She was beginning to speak just a little bit. And so I pointed to someone in the room and said, "Who's that?" And she said, "That's mommy." And I pointed to another person, "Who's that?" "Daddy." "Who's that?" So the other person said the name. And so she knew people's names a little bit and went around. And then I pointed to her and I said, "Who's that?" And she said, "I am." And I said, I'm kind of slow, right? So so that's what makes the story interesting. So I pointed to her again, who's that? And she said again, "I am." And since I'm really slow sometimes, I said it a third time. And then she stood up really tall and strong and kind of strong and said, "I am." And then I remembered what the bush said to Moses. I said, "Okay." You know, then please keep it there. So I want to go on because the last one, if I may. So this is the one that supposed to be first, but you know, you would have shut down probably. So you ready for this?
Yes.
So the attachment to sensual pleasures. Self is harder. You think so? These four are considered the kind of the four most insidious forms of clinging. So why is it that the clinging to self sensual desire is so insidious and so deep, and why is it that I kind of so carefully waited to the end to talk about it? Yes.
I don't know.
First thing that came to mind was food. Very attached to food.
And do you have any understanding why? What's the glue?
I'll think about that.
Yeah. Okay. So back all the way back in the corner. Been trying for a while here. So let's make sure.
Is there really anything wrong with sensual pleasure unless you really obsess over it?
See, there's a difference between sensual pleasure and clinging to sensual pleasure. So in all these clingings, it isn't the object which is the problem of the clinging, but it's the nature of the clinging itself. So, you know, enjoying ice cream, there's nothing really wrong with enjoying ice cream. But if you're sitting here at the edge of a seat, I wish Gil hadn't mentioned it earlier today. Now I'm just thinking about ice cream the whole time. I hardly listen to the talk, and I can't get rid of these ice cream thoughts. That's not sensual pleasure. That's being consumed with desire for sensual pleasure.
So kind of like addiction?
Kind of like addiction, yes. So I think it's important, the distinction you're making, because we're not asking people to let go of sensual pleasures, but to the clinging to them, the addiction to them. And if we're not addicted to sensual pleasures, then the chances are much better that we'll do them in... We'll pursue sensual pleasure, we'll engage in sensual pleasures in a way that doesn't cause harm to others. But if the attachment and clinging is there, it's a lot easier to, for example, do it unethically. Unethically in Buddhism means to do it in a way that causes harm. Oh, yes, up here in the front. Can you wait for the mic?
I'll speak loudly.
Well, no, it's not. It's for a variety of reasons why we use the mic.
Well, I think, basically, we're all animals, and I think a lot of the sensual things come up from our animal roots.
So we just go ahead and be animals?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. But I'm just telling you where I think it comes from, quite different. Uh-huh. And so that's what gives you the glue, is some of that.
So the biological thing,
yes.
The urge and all that. Okay. And again, it's interesting. So then, if it's kind of built into our DNA in a sense, are we then stuck to just be that way, or is it other options?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, no.
Great, thank you. Maybe we can have someone new speak now, because
the last statement or. When you were talking about the letting go and the clinging, it was difficult for me to understand or to feel, when is it clinging, when is it letting go, and when is one just doing what one, having sensual pleasure or going towards sensual pleasure because it's part of survival, like the gentleman was saying, it's your animal nature. You know, you
to have ice cream.
Figure out. So when is that wanting? When is that magnet, that pull? It seems like there's a really fine line between the magnet and the no magnet.
It's a great question, and so. You know, there are certainly biological urges that we have, but most biological urges are not in the form of sensual desire, though sensual desires are part of it and part of maybe the hook for it. But like the urge to eat, the urge to drink, the urge to procreate, which is very deep in our kind of instincts to do, but that's very different than, you know, the urge for... lots of delicious food, the urge for lots of delicious sex, the urge for lots of delicious, pleasures of all kinds. And so I wonder, you know, the difference between, so this is where the attachment to sensual pleasure might be different from urges. And urges, instinctual urges, what role should they have in our lives? What's our relationship to them? And I think the relationship to them gets complicated by these other things we cling to. And the meaning we assign to them, the stories we assign to them, the sensual pleasures they provide and attachment to it, the sense of self that's connected to it, and also religion ideas that are connected to it. All this can really entangle a lot, get entangled with these kinds of deeper urges. You know, those deeper urges didn't have all this extra stuff to it. It's possible their urges would be held quite lightly. I mean, that's the investigation to find out. So we should stop because we're now running over. And one of the things people cling to is time. And people cling to their sleep for all four reasons. So anyway, so what I hope this evening did for all of you, and generally the talks at IMC, is not to so much give you ideas or things to believe in, but give you, provoke you in a good way to something to reflect and think and explore in your lives. And I hope that during this next week that you will explore a little bit what's the nature of the glue that keeps you attached, and then what are some of the things you cling to, and how is it these four categories of clinging operate in your life in ways that actually are a hindrance for you, actually, you know, are, you know, you'd be a better off person if you didn't have that clinging. So, and I hope that as you do that, you enjoy it. It brings you pleasure. Thank you.